and putting the link in the chat again for those who just joined. And this is week three, the concluding week for Los Pensadores, the Jewish philosophers of medieval Spain. I've got an email asking about continuing on this at some point in the future. We may well do that. We certainly have not exhausted all of the philosophers, that's for sure. So we'll have to see how, when, and so on. I did include in the email with the source sheet this week the promotion for our next series, which starts not this coming Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. It's The House That David Built, the stories of three kings, Shlomo, King Solomon, Rehavam, son of Shlomo, and I believe I have Yoshiyahu on there, Josiah. And remarkably different people with remarkably different experiences, and something I'm really looking forward to. So please make sure that you register for that course. I know this is always the problem. You get to the end of a month and you're talking about something that's in the next month. It always feels like it's a long way away. But November is almost here.
I'm so confused with everything that I don't remember what I registered and paid and what I didn't.
Well, email Ronit and she can tell you. She's keeping track. Yeah. Okay. So we started last week talking about Rabbeinu Nisim, also known as the Ran, born roughly the year 1310. And lives in northern Spain, as do all of those we're talking about in this series. Primarily lives in Barcelona. We talked about him as a leader in the Jewish community in his day, as well as a great Torah scholar. But our main focus is his political theory. And we started to talk about that by presenting a problem. As we saw in sources last week, the book of Bereishit of Genesis assumes that there are going to be kings. There's a prediction given to Jacob, kings are going to emerge from you. And we're told that the scepter will never leave the tribe of Judah. Like, there's an understanding that we are going to have kings. However, we saw Deuteronomy chapter 17, a little less clear. It talks about how when you come into the land and you say, I'm going to have a king, then you shall place a king upon you. But it sounds like it's when you say it. I'm sorry, Ruchama?
And then in Dvarim, he said, Lo yarvelo nashim.
That's a separate discussion. We're going to get into that in the next series in November with Shlomo HaMelech, with King Solomon. So we're going to have to talk about that one then. 1,000 counts as Lo Yarbet. But that'll be a discussion then. The question is, are we supposed to have a king or not? And then we moved into Shmuel, the book of Samuel, Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1, chapter 8, and we saw that the people asked for a king, and Samuel is horrified. He thinks that this is terrible. And he turns to God and complains, and God says to him, it's not you, it's me. They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me, and I think you should go ahead and do it. And I just don't understand at all what exactly was wrong about the request for a king if, in fact, they're supposed to have one. And various answers are offered centering on how they asked. So maybe it's because they asked while they still were being led by Shmuel, by the prophet Samuel. You're not supposed to do that, unseating a very accomplished and loyal leader like that is inappropriate. Or maybe it's because we asked to have a king in order to be like our neighbors. We saw the language last week. They said, we want a king like everybody around us. Now, there's a lot to be said about that language, and it's not really for right now. What I wanted to do with the opening part of our time today is to show you how Rabbeinu Nisim dealt with this, because he argued that what was wrong was the type of king, the type of monarchy they wanted, because what the Torah wants, as he understands it, is a constitutional monarchy with separation of powers. Something that really anticipates a world which you didn't really see much back then in 14th century Spain. the Magna Carta exists by then, but the Magna Carta is not quite the grand document as though it's presented when you learn about it in elementary school. That's its own discussion. I mean, really, how much really is like what they tell you in elementary school? But anyway, but I digress. What we're going to do is see how Rabbeinu Nissim articulates this. So if you take a look on the source sheet, and I put the link in the chat again for those who just joined. This comes from his 11th speech in his work, Drashot Haran. And all of the pieces that we're going to quote from him are from that one, which is devoted to this theme of the monarchy, government, and what it's supposed to be like. And he says here, he first of all points out, as we saw last week, that a king is supposed to have a Torah scroll with him at all times to ensure he will follow the Torah. So take a look. He writes, because the king has great power, he didn't write this in English, this is my translation, the original is in Hebrew, but he says, because the king has great power, he is not bound to the laws of the Torah, meaning in his judicial activity, when he judges cases, as a judge is. Okay, a king, he says, can hear cases. Think of the story of King Solomon and those two women, which we're going to talk about in the course in November. The two women and the dead baby it's your baby, it's yours, and his plan of, let's split the baby. Like, leave aside that there's no intention of splitting the baby in that story. But a king is not actually required to follow biblical law when the king judges cases. And if he's not complete, as Rabbeinu Nissim continues, if he's not complete in his awe of God, he will come to exceed his bounds beyond that which is necessary for the good of society. Because a king has tremendous leeway in terms of how he handles cases, the result can be that the king is going to act inappropriately. Therefore, God commanded him to have a Torah scroll with him at all times, as per Deuteronomy 17, as we saw last week. The idea being, for him to read the commands of the Torah as a whole. If he will cancel any mitzvah due to the needs of his time, if he says, you know, right now we need to do things differently, his intent shall not be to transgress the Torah's commands in general, not to remove from himself the yoke of awe of heaven in any way, but his intent shall be exclusively to guard all of the words of this Torah. So a king is able to suspend the law in certain circumstances, and in order to assure that the king is going to follow the rules in general and only act for the sake of leading the people in the way of the Torah, he better have a Torah with him to keep him in line. So Diane puts a note in the chat. I'm going to remind everybody, please. Yeah, I prefer comments out loud as opposed to in the chat, so I don't have to monitor that also. But the question that she asks is, then, you know, what about if a king is allowed, I think if I understand the question correctly, if a king is allowed to act inappropriately. Yeah.
Sorry. If a king can act inappropriately, then what's he going to be do wrong by with his act of Bathsheba and by sending her husband out to die?
Right. So, so we'll see more as we go further in this about what Rabbeinu Nissim thinks the king is allowed to do. But you already see in source number one that the things he's allowed to do when it comes to suspending law are not about his personal gratification. Rather, it's about the good of the nation. There was nothing about the story with Bathsheba that was for the good of the nation. This was something done for himself. Now, I say this and also note a much greater dispute. So I want to bring in a little bit more in order to answer your question, but there are multiple pieces here. So first, in terms of what you're talking about, there is no justification within the king's royal powers for him to say, I know you're married to so-and-so, but you're coming with me. That doesn't fly. That does not work. Having said that, when Samuel presents the Jews with the powers of a king, he talks about how a king can take property for himself. The king is allowed to cut through people's property. The king is allowed to say, your son is now going to be my servant and is going to work in my fields and is going to serve in my army. The king is described by Samuel as having extraordinary power. And there's great debate in the Talmud and later writings as to whether Samuel is saying kings legally are able to do that, or whether he's just trying to say to the people, you know, you think you want a king, but your kings are going to be horrible, and they're going to do all these things without legal license to do it. And there's a lot of debate, and I'm not going into the whole discussion right now, but it's possible to argue that kings in Jewish law do have power to arrogate property for themselves and even to impress people into their service. But the limit is that the king is not able to for his own gratification, take someone who was a wife of so-and-so and now take her for himself. That's simply, according to no one, is that licensed. And indeed, he gets in a lot of trouble for it and suffers for the rest of his life as a result of what he did. Okay. Yes, Janine.
You mentioned separation of church and state. Was this used as a basis for separation of powers? Church and state powers. Was this used as a basis of the establishment, like different thoughts about the establishment of the state of Israel, whether it should be run by halakha or not?
Right, so separation of powers and separation of church and state are very different. Within the view of the Torah of a monarchy, there is no such thing as separation of church and state. Just the fact that he has to keep a Torah scroll with him at all times and make sure that his actions conform with Judaism's expectations tells you that there's no separation of church and state there at all. In terms of what happened with the founding of the state, so, you know, Ben-Gurion's status quo agreement and attempt to mollify, you know, the perceived right wing by agreeing to certain things that didn't fit with his personal political program was more pragmatic than philosophical. But there's a lot to be said.
I was asking about religious leaders who said that you can't run a state. I think I remember reading something, probably in one of the Toronto Torah, but someone who said that you can't run a state in today the way that, not after Yemot HaMashiach, but right now, you can't run a state based totally on, let's say, halachic
So I think what you're thinking of is something we saw from the Rashbah, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, in a different class, not when we discussed him here, I think. But Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, writing, as we know, in the 13th century, said that you can't govern based solely on the Torah's law. There is a need for new rules and enactments. If you were to try, to take your example, to try to rein in crime, requiring two witnesses and a warning and so on before you could punish a criminal, it would be a joke. And it can't work. So there is that idea that you need to go beyond it. That's not really a separation as much as it is saying we have this plus. So Rabbeinu Nissim argues that the king has extraordinary power, and therefore he needs a Torah scroll with him so that he'll stay in line. More than that, if you take a look at number 2 on the sheet, he warns the king is supposed to serve the people. And this becomes very funny. He says, because he, the king, and by the way, just in case it wasn't obvious, yes, in that formulation, biblically, the king is always the he. So, putting that out there. He says in number 2, because he rules with great control and he is set up to become arrogant, therefore God commanded him to be careful of this. The king, with all the powers that he has, is likely to become arrogant. And so God commands him not to, as the verse says, lest his heart become elevated above his brothers. This non-arrogance is a collective mitzvah for the king and for the general population, meaning all of us have a mitzvah of don't be arrogant. It's not just the king, right? This one is maybe one of the harder mitzvot, Fine. Nonetheless, we have a mitzvah of don't be arrogant, but it's directed specifically at the king here for two reasons. One, he is set up to stumble in arrogance and an elevated heart. He's being set up. You know that that's likely to happen. And two, so that we may deduce logically that this should apply for the general population. In other words, you and I should look at this and say, well, if the king is not supposed to become arrogant, how much more so I should not become arrogant? It's a lesson for everybody else. So here's something very interesting. That paragraph that I just read here in source number 2 about how the king is not allowed to become arrogant, take a look at source number 3. Professor Warren Harvey is a scholar of Rabbeinu Nisim. And in his article, Rabbi Nisim of Girona on the constitutional power of the sovereign, he writes, the entire passage that we just read is lacking in early printed editions of Drashot Haran, the Ran speeches, but found in the manuscripts. When this was printed, it was omitted. So he says, according to Feldman, who's also a scholar, it was deleted, quote, apparently by the censor. If he's right, this will be a striking case in which a Hebrew book was censored in Europe not for religious reasons, i.e. a perceived anti-Christian sentiment, but for political ones, for a bold democratic idea. The government did not like the idea of publishing a book that says the king shall not become arrogant. Then he says, it's possible, though, the passage was omitted by a copyist's error, and he goes on to note that successive paragraphs in the Hebrew start with the same word. And it's possible that it was just a copyist making a mistake, skipping a paragraph by accident. Nonetheless, I thought that was a very interesting note. But in order to fit within our time frame today, I decided not to bring you all of the separation of powers from Rabbeinu Nisim's own words, but to show you how Professor Harvey summarizes it. Because he does a very nice job in that same essay. In source number 4, he says, the division of powers between the executive branch and the judicial branch, the judges in the Sanhedrin and in the system of courts versus the king, is thus a fundamental principle for Ran. And what he means by that will become clear as we go through the paragraph, so don't worry. In this connection, he stresses the checks and balances in the political system. These checks and balances limit the power of the king, as they also limit the power of the judges and other political functionaries. Meaning, here we go. The king has the power to cancel the ruling of the judges. Judges decide on a case. The king is able to overrule them, but only on the grounds of, quote, political welfare. He can execute an uncommonly dangerous serial murderer whom the courts were unable to execute because of the rules of righteous judgment. For example, two witnesses were not present, no warning was given. However, if the king, actually pausing there for a second to make sure that's clear, the courts have limited power. In particular, when you're dealing with physical punishment, the courts require witnesses, the courts require a warning. It's very hard to carry out a punishment. But that, as I noted in, you know, answering Janine before, can lead to a lawless society if criminals know they can get away with things. So the king has the ability to punish people extrajudicially. To go outside of that framework, to say, yes, I know the court said we can't do anything, but I think we can. King is able to do that. So that gives the king the power to hold the court in check. Well, then who keeps the king in check? The king can always say, I think this is necessary for the community. So he continues, however, if the king limits the province of the judges, the prophet limits that of the king. The king is commanded in Deuteronomy that he not go aside from the commandment right or left. And Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, endorses Rashi's explanation. Even a minor command given by a prophet, the king can override the judge, but the prophet overrides the king. This is like rock, scissors, paper, right? Rock, paper, scissors match, right? So the king is able to override the court. The prophet can override the king. But then he continues. However, if the prophets limit the king, the judges limit the prophets. The judges determine the legal framework in which the prophets work and rule on who is a true prophet and who a false one. So the court can be overridden by the king, who can be overridden by the prophet, who can be overridden by the court. right? That's your system of separation of powers, and really of checks and balances. Moreover, the judges are not subjugated to the prophets regarding the judgment of the law, meaning the prophets can command the king, but cannot command the judges. If a judge rules somebody is innocent, somebody is guilty, the prophet has no power to override that. The king is required to obey the prophets, but the judges are not. Thus, there are checks on the prophets, as there are on the king and the judges. Each branch checks and is checked, and he gives you a nice summary. The king checks the judges and is checked by the prophets. The judges check the prophets and are checked by the king. And the prophets check the king and are checked by the judges. So it's a system in which everything is in balance, right? I'm most familiar with the American system, which I grew up in. And in that system, your Congress can pass laws, but the courts get to decide which laws are actually legal. The judges can decide a case. However, Congress can enact a law that's going to effectively change the system and do away with the ruling that the courts gave. And then you have, of course, the executive branch, which is its own thing. But each branch has certain powers and has certain limitations. Claudette.
My question is, do we know if there were any other society long before Barnella, you know, when Torah time, that had this kind of rules about their king? Because if not, then bringing in this kind of rules was very revolutionary.
So you're right. It sounds revolutionary. Rabbeinu Nissim, when he writes it out, shows how all of this is seen in biblical law and in the Talmud. So from his perspective, this is what was going on, or what was supposed to go on in Tanakh. I mean, those who are in our November course about the kings will find out just how much of this was followed and how much of it was not. I'm not saying that it actually worked. It was law on the books, you know, and then at the same time, there's also, you know, reality. But I don't know enough about other societies to know who else might have been having separation of powers and checks and balances. It's a good question for political science. Okay, sure. So all of this about the separation of powers as articulated by Rabbeinu Nissim brings us back to what was wrong with their request that they made of Samuel. I didn't bring you the text from Samuel itself again this week. I really should have, so we could actually look, but it's okay, because Rabbeinu Nissim is going to bring the relevant part here in source number 5. He says, in my opinion, it is this. You want to know what they did wrong? They wanted basic justice between parties to come from the throne, as in Samuel 1, chapter 8, sentences 4 and 5, which I take to mean that they thought that national order would function best when it flowed from the throne, as opposed to from the shofet, from the judge. Therefore, they said, you have aged, and you can no longer judge. They said that to Samuel. Your children are not suited to cause divine benefit to be manifest upon us, for they do not follow your ways. Therefore, it will be appropriate for us to have a king, and for our judgment to happen through him. Thus they said, place a king upon us to judge us, like all of the nations. He understands to judge us to mean literally, the king is going to handle cases. The king is going to administer justice. Had they asked for a king in general, saying, place a king upon us, or had they asked for the sake of battle, lead us in war, there would have been neither guilt nor sin in this, but a mitzvah. Their sin was only in saying, place a king upon us to judge us, like all of the nations, wanting their judgment to flow from the throne, not from judges of Torah. We see this in 8:6 in Samuel, in which it did not say, as they said, place a king upon us alone. Rather, it said to judge us. And therefore, God said to Samuel, they did not reject you. They rejected me from reigning over them. They didn't want God telling a prophet what they should do. They wanted the king to make it up. for they chose natural running of their affairs as opposed to divine control. You follow? That's the issue. So the argument of Rabbeinu Nissim is for this really, what sounds like, as Claudette was saying, a very innovative system of government, which he saw embedded in the Torah. One last note on his thought. The belief of Rabbeinu Nissim is that the king's power is rooted in popular support. And those of you who are in my Tuesday afternoon class on the Book of Kings, we just talked about this yesterday. The idea that popular support is actually what fuels royal authority in Jewish law. So that's very much an idea of Rabbeinu Nissim. The king's power comes about because the nation chooses him. And Professor Harvey, who I quoted before, says, you know, you could link that with Rabbeinu Nissim's understanding of how secular royal authority works. Meaning, we've talked about on other occasions, the Talmud has a rule. Dina de Malchuta Dina. Right? Does that sound familiar? Anybody remember that line? Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the empire is the law. That's a line out of the Talmud, and it gives the government all sorts of powers. There's some debate as to what the full scope of those powers is. The initial statement in the Talmud is about taxation, but the government has great authority under that principle. However, Rabbeinu Nissim said that's only a non-Israeli government. He said that's not true in Israel. Take a look at source number 6. Rabbeinu Nissim, who of course didn't have a Jewish government in Israel in his day, but he says, he quotes Tosafot. Tosafot is an anthology of commentaries on the Talmud from, call it, 12th to 14th century Western Europe. Tosafot wrote that it is specifically regarding non-Jewish kings that we recognize the law of the empire, because the land belongs to him. And he can say, if you do not follow my laws, I will evict you from the land, right? It's like the schoolyard all over again. Right? I brought the football, so I decide who plays and I decide what the rules are. That's the way it works in a secular system. But, writes Rabbeinu Nissim, I see you, Ruchama, but I want to finish the line. But Jewish kings cannot do this. For all Israel are partners in the land of Israel. All of us have a share in the land of Israel, and therefore he doesn't own the land. So Professor Harvey says, that's really interesting. What he is doing is he saying, because I believe that a king's power comes from the nation, therefore a king in Israel is not going to have the ability to make rules over the people on his own because it's not his land. And in fact, when there's no king, that political power will revert to the nation. And that's sort of its own discussion, which I brought you source number 7, but I'm going to skip it here because it's an interesting application for modern democracy that I don't want to go into right now. But that's just a little bit of the political philosophy of Rabbeinu Nissim. Ruchama, what were you going to say?
It's the same thing as Malchut.
Well, that's also expedient, right? That's also practical. Right? Ruchama quotes the passage from the Mishnah in Avot, which says we should pray for the welfare of the government. Without that, each person would swallow up the next. That's a pragmatic and important pragmatic consideration. Okay, so that's Rabbeinu Nissim. I'm glad to say we still have half an hour for Rabbi Yosef Albo.